Welcome to Pediatrics Now, cases, updates, and discussions for the busy practitioner. I'm your host, Holly Waymont. I work for UT Health San Antonio's Department of Pediatrics. In this podcast, we explore how we can provide the best, most cutting-edge, compassionate care for children. We hope to give you a unique and behind-the-scenes edge from our expert guests. After listening, click on the link on this podcast for free credit. Today, I'm bringing you Grand Rounds. Let's listen in.
Thank you for attending Pediatrics Grand Rounds today. And we have a treat this morning. We have our own Dr. Glenn Medellin, who's going to be introducing our speaker for today.
Yes, good morning, everybody. So I'm really excited to introduce Dr. Julie Hauer. She did her training in Minnesota and then was one of the really the first pediatric palliative care fellows and went to Harvard there and has been instrumental in starting pediatric palliative care as a specialty. And we're just reflecting that when we first started, that there were just a couple of us around the table at the national conventions, and now we're growing into an established specialty. But what Julie has always been the person to go to for when we're trying to understand complex symptoms in our children. And I always kind of consider her like a horse whisperer. She's able to look at these children with special needs and help us understand what's going on inside them. And she's really helped me understand things like visceral hyperalgesia and overfeeding our children with special needs. And also then just really looking at the quality of life for these children. She's been working with the NeuroJourney with Courageous Parents Network, which is a way for parents to connect with other parents and understand the journey that they're on when they have a child with neurologic impairment, which has been a very powerful tool. And clinically, she works at Seven Hills, which is pediatrics, which is a facility for children with complex needs and for consultative and also for long-term care. And so with that, let's turn it over to Julie and see what she has to say.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Glenn. And I was delighted to be invited to give this presentation, first and foremost, because I have such high regards for Glenn and the work that he has also done over the years. So I'm delighted to be with you to really focus on this topic of chronic pain in children with neurological impairment, and to provide a framework that gets at the multiple sources that can contribute to symptoms in this patient population. I have nothing of financial relevance to disclose, though I will be discussing some off-label use of medications. My objectives are to recognize barriers to treatment of chronic pain in children with severe neurological impairment, to consider and develop a screening process for neuro pain sources in children with severe neurological impairment, and to demonstrate multimodal chronic symptom treatment. So, children with severe neurological impairment are defined as those who have a disorder of the central nervous system that results in motor and intellectual disability with associated medical complexity. Such children can present to us in a state of agitation and irritability. And these are descriptive terms indicating that a child is in an unpleasant state of arousal. And there are a finite number of broad categories that can result in such a child being agitated and irritable. First and foremost, parents become adept at recognizing their child's unmet needs, such as the need to be repositioned and the need for personal care. We should also always consider emotional changes that can result in irritability, such as a child who is indicating through their agitation and attempting to communicate that they're actually bored and wanting more social interaction. Or it could be a child is always agitated when encountering the healthcare system. And then there are certainly the broad medical categories of acute medical illness, chronic medical conditions, acute drug toxicity and drug withdrawal, and then finally, acute and chronic sources of pain. Now, pain as a category is so important when we consider children with severe neurological impairment. And this is just a summary that's really reminding us we have a call to arms in those who have recurrent pain by recognizing that in many children with severe neurological impairment, pain can be weekly to daily. And the pain that does occur can be of high intensity. And then the complexity is that there's potential for multiple sources that I'll go through. And then of the sources that receive treatment, in many, some degree of pain can still continue after treatment of those known sources. To illustrate the points that I'll be covering today, I'm going to start with this case example of a 14-year-old boy with this specific genetic condition. He meets the definition of severe neurological impairment in that he's non-ambulatory and non-verbal, though he still communicates with facial expression and vocalization. He has a gastrostomy feeding tube for his nutrition and to receive medications. He has a well-controlled seizure disorder on one medication. And his two issues that have been long-standing are very intractable insomnia and this cycle of emesis that occurs about every 3 weeks that has gone on for years. He's been comprehensively evaluated by a pediatric gastroenterologist, and his emesis condition has been categorized as cyclic vomiting syndrome. He's also been followed by a wonderful complex care specialist and evaluated by a sleep specialist. He's had multiple normal studies, as well as multiple interventions that have not had sustained benefit in lessening the recurrence of these emesis episodes or improved his sleep. And the concern at this point in his life is that he hasn't had weight gain for 3 years, and his weight is quite low in comparison to his length. And so it's even raised questions about the need for, or I don't like to use the term need, but really the role potentially of parenteral nutrition. So our team is consulted, and I will later review questions that were utilized that got at this recognition that even on his good days without emesis, he was frequently agitated, though his mother would say she wasn't sure she would call it that he was experiencing pain. But with the information that we gathered, he was treated with gabapentin as well as a nighttime dose of clonidine. And his results were what I would actually call better than expected, in given the length of his symptoms that he had. So his emesis episodes then reduced significantly so that they were infrequent. And when they occurred, were much less intense and easy to manage. And his sleep improved dramatically. He was really viewed as being like a new kid. He had very rapid weight gain of 35% over 4 months. And that was viewed being due to a reduction of his emesis, as well as a reduction in agitation that included muscle tensing. There was even a need to reduce his calories eventually by a total of 22%. And he had this benefit for 2.5 years. And then 2.5 years later, he had a fragility fracture that required orthopedic surgery. And then weeks after surgery, he started to have these persistent symptoms that increased over time. There was no new explanation identified for them, including not due to surgery. There was no benefit from an increase in his gabapentin dose. And his emesis episodes also returned. Eventually, he was started on nortriptyline and his gabapentin was continued, and he had significant improvement with that combination. I wanted to start with his case to get at two fundamental questions. Why the delay? And the delay wasn't because of lack of good care. I would really propose that it's lack of a sufficient screening process for this patient population to get at chronic symptoms and management. And then I will also later get back to the question of why the return of symptoms. So chronic pain delay, I just want to highlight a few themes from a retrospective review that hasn't yet been published, in which I looked at 41 individuals with severe neurological impairment who eventually had chronic pain treatment and benefit from that treatment in most. And the themes that were identified as symptom delay was common. There was often an explanation that became the anchor of why the symptoms continued. So some of the examples provided here. And often the problem wasn't viewed as pain, similar to this case example, because it's hard to know, should we call it pain? And then finally, neuropathic pain categories that I'll review were often not considered. And it, again, wasn't because of lack of good care, it's lack of tests and criteria to indicate when that's occurring in this patient population. And then finally, there remains a need to recognize that bias, specific or generally, and then specifically assumptions about pain still continue for this patient population. To highlight the bias and assumptions, this was a phrase I heard from somebody else 4 months ago. He doesn't feel pain like others. That was an opportunity then to reframe that we know to expect that this child's pain experience is the same as a neurotypical child's pain experience. The difference is he can't use words to express his pain experience. And then finally, I like to just remind all of us, when the work I do is always focused on the problems that such children have. And I've had to remind myself that such children are not defined only by their problems. They're defined also by the abilities that all children with severe neurological impairment have that are measured in meaningful activities and relationships that we often don't see in the healthcare system. So moving forward to the multiple causes that can result in acute and recurrent pain and irritability in such children. Given that there are many conditions to consider, I want to provide a framework to help make this into something more manageable by reminding us of three broad categories. So the first category are the nociceptive sources that when they occur, those sources will result in tissue injury and inflammation. And then that will result in an expected pain signal that alerts to a problem in need of identification and management. Now, the reference that I have here, along with another reference, which is the American Academy of Pediatrics clinical report on pain in this population, reviews all of the specific nociceptive sources in detail. But really, this is just a reminder that to consider these sources, we have to know what such children are at risk for. So it could include that a child who's unable to fully close their eyelids at night is then at risk for corneal ulceration and keratitis as a source to consider and have evaluated by an ophthalmologist if a child has a history of recurrent treatment for conjunctivitis, as an example. And knowing that such children are often on multiple drugs, so considering could there have been a new drug added that contributes to drug toxicity because there are multiple drugs with the same mechanism of action. And then in the hospital setting, considering delirium as a contributing factor. Then the next category I want to review are what I categorize as neural problems. And these are the problems that I would highlight as having criteria and tests to identify them. So we know the criteria that indicate that a child has spasticity and or dystonia. We have a test to identify when a child has seizures. And we have information to know that a child with an adolescent onset neurodegenerative condition will have dementia features that can result in irritability as, again, considerations. And then finally, the neuropain sources that I'm going to spend a little bit more time on, given that this is a category that lacks tests and criteria. So these sources are central neuropathic pain due to alterations in the thalamus in the central nervous system, and as well as the spinal thalamic tract. Visceral hyperalgesia due to sensitization of the visceral afferents that generate and send pain signals. Autonomic dysfunction due to alterations of the autonomic nervous system. And then finally, post-surgical pain, which is a less frequent category but important to recognize. This has been best studied in adults where a small percent can go on to have persistent pain without an explanation that is viewed as being generated by changes in the nervous system that result in neuropathic pain. And you'll see that I have all of these categorized under this one term of neuropain that I define as chronic pain sources due to the altered nervous system that children with SNI are at risk for. Yet, these are problems that, again, lack diagnostic testing criteria. In addition, they lack distinct features to differentiate one from another. Yet, that part isn't as important because they're all treated with similar chronic treatment strategies. The way that I would propose we think of these neuropain sources is to recognize that we should consider them when pain features continue to recur following treatment of the known nociceptive sources, as well as the neuroproblem sources that can also contribute to symptoms. So it's considering them after treatment of such problems as spasticity, gastroesophageal reflux disease, and management of sleep. Another way to think of this is a summary of the evidence that we have that summarizes what are the presenting features that we see in children who have these neural pain sources that improve after treatment directed at these sources. The most common presenting feature are recurrent episodes that include muscle stiffening, muscle tensing, as well as increased or persistent movement during episodes that continues after treatment of spasticity and dystonia. The second most common presenting category that occurs in probably about 3/4 of such children is recurrent symptoms that are localized to the abdomen with or without emesis that continues after treatment of reflux and constipation. Not surprisingly, another common presenting feature is continued disruptive sleep that can continue after treatment of sleep. And then some unique features and considerations include that autonomic features are common, and those can be due to either autonomic dysfunction, or they can also be due to the other chronic neural pain sources, given that any source of pain will stimulate the autonomic nervous system and result in autonomic features of tachycardia, hypertension, and sweating. So autonomic features can be due to neural pain sources and autonomic dysfunction specifically. And then intractable seizures is common in those with neural pain. And this should be viewed as a marker. It's a marker indicating a more impaired central nervous system that has higher risk for the other sources that can result in neural pain. And then a unique finding or features is acute apneic events that can possibly be explained by muscle stiffening that includes chest wall tensing that results in these acute desaturation episodes that are recurrent that can improve after treatment of neural pain sources. To kind of corral that information together, this is just an initial screening tool that's in need of further study. So it's not that I can recommend that it's a standard approach, but it's kind of the next iteration of improving our ability to screen for neural pain to help us improve an earlier introduction of chronic pain treatment for such children. So this is really a tool that I call here the neural pain risk assessment tool. That's from that retrospective data summarized in the prior slide. It's single center and unvalidated. And it's intended to be applied to children who meet the definition of SNI, who have had a comprehensive assessment, and they continue to have recurrent episodes that include pain behaviors after treatment of known sources. The tool includes a summary of the common types of pain behaviors, which again are the features we see in such children when they experience pain. And so again, it reminds that the episodes must include some of these pain features of changes in baseline vocalizations, facial expression, difficulty in being consoled, changes in interaction, the physiological changes of tachycardia as an example, and then that increased muscle tone and tensing and movement. And then just to highlight a few examples from this, from the prior slide, it includes reviewing, do the episodes include muscle tensing and increased tone, movement, and changes in posture during episodes that those features continue following one or more drugs directed at spasticity or dystonia. And that it might include GI symptoms localized with some specific examples given that continue after treatment of gastroesophageal reflux disease. And then the final part is identifying, does a child have episodes that suggest pain? But the way that I want to really highlight what might improve our ability to screen for this is to screen for lack of calm. We know what calm looks like in everybody. What's harder to know is, just like that case example, is a parent trying to answer the question, does your child have recurrent pain? So some screening questions that helped us with this case example that I mentioned is to ask questions, is Grace often calm, happy, and relaxed? It sounds like she has times when she's irritable. Does she easily become irritable for different reasons? When these episodes occur, how much do they impact Grace having good days? Are there interventions that you're using frequently in an effort to help Grace be calm? How often are these episodes occurring? When they occur, how long does it take for Grace to be calm again? So as you can tell from these screening questions, it's really getting at, are days, Grace's days, not as good as we would desire for her with that information? Then when we've identified that there's lack of routine calm, then we can equate that Grace is often irritable and pain is a source to consider. One way that I think of this is that means Grace has symptoms without easy answers. It can mean that there is treatment directed at problems that might have resulted in some reduction in those problems, but it still will get at, just like this case example, that it's not sufficient to provide calm days on a routine basis. So it's exploring beyond the name problem so we don't become too anchored to what is known. Then I can highlight this to a parent. I'm glad that interventions have improved Grace's spasticity, or I'm glad that they've improved her sleep. I'm glad that when you vent her G-tube each day, that her GI symptoms are lessened. It also sounds like she still has frequent agitation that occurs at times, and that it involves a lot of interventions to help her be less agitated. Then that allows me to shift with a parent to that category of nerve pain. So I can acknowledge to a parent, as you know, we've done a lot of assessment and interventions for the nociceptive sources, the pain sources that can generate pain because of inflammation and injury of tissue. I also want to consider now another pain source that can occur in children like Grace that can be due to the altered nervous system, a source of pain we call neuropathic. Though there are no tests for this type of pain, I know that Grace is at risk for this type of pain, and she has features we see with this type of pain. So now that we've done that process of thinking of the broad categories that can result in recurrent irritability and pain, and there's been a comprehensive assessment, and there's been a screening process, and now we're looking at the persistent irritability that might be due to those chronic neuropain sources. Now I want to shift to the chronic symptom treatment process by reviewing non-pharmacologic, the process of managing chronic comorbid problems, and the consideration of neuropain drug trials. So non-pharmacologic is important, and it still remains an underutilized, and part of that is because many families don't have access to effective non-pharmacologic strategies. What I really want to propose is that we give more consideration to scheduled non-pharmacologic strategies that include music therapy, a therapy that gets at pressure and vibration, such as massage therapy, deep pressure modalities, or vibrations such as vibratory mat, or access to pool therapy and whirlpool. This is an untapped area for more study. What I can share is I've been struck over the years how a universal theme I hear from parents described is they'll say, my child is in such a better state of calm for days after each of these sessions, for those families who do have access to such therapy. The need for studies is so that we can highlight the benefit and hopefully have more children who have access to such non-pharmacologic strategies. And then there's also a role for non-pharmacologic strategies during breakthrough episodes. And this is these strategies are reviewed in great detail in the American Academy of Pediatrics clinical report. So it'd be things such as use of a vibratory mat during an episode, not just when on a scheduled basis. Removing orthotics that child might be tensing against as examples. A second category is to consider GI tract distension as a contributing factor to symptom generation. First and foremost, it's the reason this is important is in recognizing that the neuro pain sources that I highlighted can result in a change in the GI tract threshold that results in pain generation. So it can be a change in the threshold where a lower degree of distension can generate a pain signal. So that's why the importance of management of constipation can be of benefit. And then looking to see, is there a potential for excessive intestinal gas that's described by the parent? And then reviewing, are there any drugs in use that might be contributing to that? So one under-recognized source to consider is chronic use of proton pump inhibitor can be a contributing factor, or considering small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And then the management strategy of venting the gastrostomy feeding tube. And then finally, as Glenn actually mentioned in his introduction, that one consideration in non-ambulatory children with SNI who have a gastrostomy feeding tube, there are a number of reasons that can result in excess estimation of calories. And so sometimes a calorie reduction can also contribute and help with symptom reduction. So those are strategies that are important to consider in all children. In this framework, obviously, if we have insufficient management and there are recurrent episodes, there will be a need for scheduled pharmacologic strategies to help mitigate the symptom generation through the altered nervous system so that we can dampen pain signals and decrease the severity, frequency, and duration of episodes that are occurring. I have drugs categorized as established versus consider. The established drugs have long-term safety information that's better established and better efficacy information. And the long-term consideration is important given that neuro pain sources that exist require lifelong use of drugs, just like we use for spasticity and seizures in such children. The consider categories represent drugs that we have less safety information about lifelong use, we have less efficacy data, and some of them have not been studied in this patient population at all or to much of a degree. And these are drugs that might have been better studied in cancer patients as an example, such as ketamine being studied and demonstrating a decrease in opioid need in a cancer patient with pain. But I'll go through a few of these drugs. Gabapentinoids, and specifically gabapentin, are recommended first-line medication because of the high safety as well as the efficacy data that we do have. Any drug that is used requires expert knowledge, and that includes knowledge of starting dose, a titration phase, and then a goal dose. Information is summarized in the reference I have listed here, which is available online. With gabapentin, the main point to highlight is to know that pharmacokinetic data highlights that younger children need a 30% higher milligram per kilogram per day dose than older children. The second point I want to highlight is reviewing with parents being prepared for increased sleeping in the first week. And this can be phrased that increased sleeping that first week means the drug is working, given that chronic pain is exhausting. The second point is to review medications in use so that we can prepare a parent that if sedation does persist, that what drug would make best sense to decrease if that's occurring. And the point that's important to recognize is that when a medication is used that results in pain reduction, that medication then can unmask sedation from another drug. Another way to think of that is if a child's on, say, 2 benzodiazepines and the dose of one has been increased and is quite high, that pain that continues will mitigate the sedating effect of that higher dose. Pain reduction then can unmask the sedation from that. So rather than decreasing and weaning the drug that has finally achieved pain reduction, sometimes what makes better sense is to reduce the dose of other drugs that are in use and might have been increased, such as a benzodiazepine or a high dose of a baclofen dose as an example. Second, we should be prepared to add a second drug directed at neural pain by recognizing the adult data that shows us that adults with neuropathic pain, over half will have benefit with two or more drugs. We also have efficacy data in adults that two drugs with different mechanisms of action can provide greater benefit than either neuropathic pain drug used solely. Yet before adding a second drug, we should always have a consistent process to ensure we're giving a comprehensive consideration before adding polypharmacy. So anytime there's insufficient benefit with that first drug, or in that case example, if symptom escalation returns and persists, we're going to want to obviously go back to the basics of a comprehensive history exam and diagnostic tests. We want to again revisit what comorbid problems might exist and the management directed at those. Sometimes it might mean identifying something that hasn't been previously identified, such as dysmenorrhea in a pubertal girl with menses that could be a contributing factor. And then maximizing the drug dose in use. And then finally, reviewing event frequency and breakthrough care plan. And this is important given that, that we can modify symptom generation with scheduled drugs, but given that the altered nervous system is generating the recurrent symptoms, we might not be able to eliminate all episodes. So it's a chance to get at, are we achieving good enough symptom control? So my general rule of thumb is that if there are three or fewer episodes on average on a weekly basis over a four-week time period, and the breakthrough care plan is effective at managing each episode, that might be good enough. And I also mentioned looking over a four-week time period, given that there can be these occasional weeks without a good explanation that have an increased frequency that can then improve after that week. And so the importance of not changing drugs too soon or adding a second drug. And then some guidance on selecting a second drug. I want to go through the medications I had listed as drugs to consider that have, again, more safety and efficacy information. So information that can help guide the addition of clonidine, and it really involves knowing some of the efficacy data. So clonidine has been studied for dystonia and spasticity. So if a child has recurrent episodes that include a lot of significant dystonic movement and spasms, that could be a reason why that's the second add-on. Or if there's high autonomic features, such as a baseline elevated blood pressure or elevated body temperature as features. In contrast, a tricyclic antidepressant might make better sense in the child who has hypotonia, such as truncal hypotonia. In the child who's ambulatory, recognizing that the main hypotension risk is really orthostatic hypotension in the individual who's able to stand independently and then could be at risk for a fall and injury. Another way to look at it would be to review the child's blood pressure and identify that their baseline blood pressure is often at the 50th percentile for age, sex, and length. And then there is an added benefit with tricyclic that it requires less frequent dosing. And then finally, methadone might be my second add-on, though it requires obviously expertise in use. But I might consider if it's a child who has frequent respiratory illness that is resulting in symptom generation that could include dyspnea. Methadone has two benefits in use in that it can be beneficial for neuropathic pain, and it, by its mu receptor property, can also be beneficial for both pain as well as dyspnea. So that would be a reason why I might consider. And then also by knowing these other drugs, it's a reminder to know who has the expertise in use to seek input from. Another aspect with management is that there's going to be multiple sources for consideration. So one thing that can be a useful strategy is by considering all of the potential contributing factors. So again, the neural problems that exist as spasticity and dystonia, recognizing that neural pain as a source can trigger and worsen spasticity and dystonia. So sometimes considering kind of alternating between those two categories. And then factoring other in other symptoms. So if a child has insomnia like that first child, could be a higher dose of gabapentin at night or a dose of clonidine at night. I mentioned dyspnea, and then I'll mention dementia in a moment. With clonidine, this is a summary of guidance on drug, kind of the starting dose and titration, and what might be an average dose that we know from the literature. And that's, again, summarized in the reference that I have. What I mainly want to also highlight, though, is that to get in the habit of reviewing a child's baseline blood pressure by looking at the tables that tell us for a child's age, sex, and length, and recognizing that often the blood pressure at baseline can be at the 90th percentile if a child has chronic neuropain source, because pain stimulates the autonomic nervous system. And this is important so that when there's a drop in blood pressure, we don't view it as hypotension. We recognize that it's actually decreasing the blood pressure closer to the 50th percentile for that child, so that we don't overstate the risk for the child. I did want to just briefly mention one of the medications I had in that other category by just highlighting some recent data from adults with dementia, where they're studying the use of intranasal dexmedetomidine as a as-needed drug that might be of benefit. And the reason I wanted to highlight this is that we obviously need studies in children, and yet we can still start by looking at the information that is being gained in adults with similar disorders, and recognizing that agitation from dementia in the neurodegenerative conditions there can be a phase where it can be very difficult to manage, and it helps to know of potential kind of as needed medication for consideration. Though dexmedetomidine is of shorter duration compared to, say, enteral clonidine, it may have less of a orthostatic hypotension effect in a child who's still ambulatory, again, for a consideration in expertise of use and management of complex symptoms. What I want to end with is this other question I mentioned of why can symptom escalation return without a testable cause? First is puberty is definitely one aspect in this patient population to consider. And then the second is to consider and review with parents that it is possible that symptom escalation can be a result of a sensitizing event. The two that we know of in the literature is that, again, that post-surgical chronic pain category I mentioned earlier, and then also acute illness that results in severe systemic inflammation can be sensitizing to the nervous system. And in some children can then be a sensitizing event that results in persistent symptom escalation. And that's where coming back to that whole process again of how can we better manage the symptom that's continuing. And then neurodegeneration is the other consideration that certainly is reported for the reasons already mentioned, as well as just aging, and then obviously with neurodegenerative disease. And then giving consideration that some symptom escalation is treatable, some might remain more intractable as there is progression of the child's condition. And I just want to end with this reminder that children with severe neurological impairment can have multiple problems that are chronic and are due to the impaired nervous system. And those are problems without cure. We often can encounter this tension point where we're having a return of problems and we're looking to see what's the likelihood we can modify the outcome. We should always be striving to modify back to the desired outcome of a desired level of health and quality of life. What I have framed here is it's achieving a level of desired thriving. And that's a picture that requires the parent perspective to know what has that looked like in the past and what are we achieving going forward? And looking to see, can we restore baseline or can we return to a good baseline, even if it's not the prior baseline? And the questions to ask are, what have been tried? What more can we try? What's the likelihood to modify? Has there been a sensitizing aspect that might be resulting in neurodegeneration? And is this transient or persistent? And I wanted to just summarize this to really highlight that such children and their families really deserve and benefit from an iterative framing process. This is just kind of a guideline, but there are other ways to think of the language to use. But what I really want to highlight here is the framework where when we first use first and second drugs directed at neuropain sources as an example, or for other chronic problems due to the nervous system, the first or second interventions, I can frame this that I expect benefit with the second drug, though I can't guarantee it. The second category I have is where I spend most of my time, which is benefit is possible with this next intervention, with this third drug, though it may not be as much as we want or have seen in the past. And then that becomes an iterative process of monitoring the outcome and seeing what we can achieve. And then this is the part I can't spend more time on, but I do want to acknowledge there can be a growing aspect of problems that are becoming less responsive to interventions where I can start to shift to my worries. I am worried that Grace's problems are greater than our best treatments. I will share approaches to care that might make sense for Grace. Your thoughts are as important as my information. Before sharing a worry, what I wanted to end with is this reminder of all the steps reviewed here so that we're ensuring ourselves that we're having a comprehensive, consistent checklist to ensure that comprehensive process. And then equally important that we can reflect back to a parent what we have, what has been taking place in this process to gain their trust and confidence. So it's going back to the comprehensive nature and revisiting what is all of the considerations that can result in acute and chronic nociceptive symptom generation, reviewing the polypharmacy in use to see is there a potential for a combination of drugs that has a drug impact on irritability that's persistent. How can we maximize the non-pharmacologic strategies that can benefit such children? How can we look at all of the comorbid considerations? Revisiting the GI tract triggers in this is the one place where I would highlight thinking of the total nutrition being used. One thing that can be part of insidious decline in this group of children is that their metabolism can be slowly decreasing, but it's not going to be an observable change. And so one of the things that can benefit some children is to actually make a 25 to 30% reduction in calories and describe to parents that what we're doing is determining what your child's nutritional needs are at this point in your child's life. That we're not taking away needed nutrition. We're actually trying to determine what is necessary and will be appropriate for a child. And then we can work with dietitians to ensure that they still receive their protein and micronutrient needs. And then for the reasons mentioned earlier, I would always want to ensure there's two neuropain drugs that are being utilized for a child. And then finally, one aspect is sometimes looking to see, is there a complex care plan where some of the interventions that are being used have become more stimulating, overstimulating for the child and is having less benefit. So sometimes we can achieve better symptom control by putting aside things such as cough assist that has been used chronically for mucus clearance of the airway as an example. So with that summary, I hope this has provided kind of a framework to think of how we can identify pain and irritability in such children, that we consider all of the acute nociceptive sources. We recognize the chronic sources, some that can be nociceptive, such as dysmenorrhea, some that are neuro problems, and then to consider the neuropain sources. And then we really create a comprehensive chronic management process that utilizes non-pharmacologic, accounts for the comorbid problems, looks at the GI tract triggers, looks at the drugs in use, and ensures an acute chronic management plan, and then modify that as needed. So with that, and we have about 12 minutes left, I hope that there are some questions that this has helped generate that we can then explore in more detail with the time that's remaining.
Yes, so Dr. Gross, you raised your hand. Did you have a question or comment?
Can you hear me, Glenn?
Yeah, we can.
Dr. Howard, thank you for a really outstanding presentation. I am a pediatric neurologist, and I was impressed with that first presentation, that first clinical case of the recurring cyclical vomiting. And the first thing that came to my mind was a possible migraine variant, which presents often as cyclical vomiting. Yeah. And nortriptyline is one of our drugs of choice. And your second or third slide showed him responding well to nortriptyline. So I guess the question or the comment is that in addition to this population having very specific problems, they can also have common problems.
Yeah.
Migraine is very common in the general population, and I assume it would be to some extent common in this population as well. Are there other common conditions that you look at when looking at pain in this population?
Yes. Oh, thank you. This is such an important point. And migraine as an example, I think, is important given that the need to consider it and yet the inability to really consider it in this patient population who can't give a history. This child specifically, there was not a family history of that to lean one way or the other, though obviously that doesn't have to be the case. And then what you're highlighting is important, that still being able to kind of bring back to the discussion other aspects that we're familiar with that are common that can be part of the discussion, and I think can also increase a family's confidence in kind of the management strategies. It could even raise the question, it wouldn't be inappropriate to start with a tricyclic. I always start with gabapentin because of the greater safety profile, and that this just happened to be a child where that provided benefit for 2.5 years. And then in terms of other common things, I would say that dysmenorrhea would probably be the other most common thing. I think people are pretty good at thinking about it who see this patient population routinely. It obviously requires that history to determine, is it true and unrelated? Is there truly a cyclical nature that corresponds with menses? And then exploring what would be management strategies related to menses that we would use in any adolescent where there is dysmenorrhea occurring. And that for some individuals would be sufficient in achieving symptom management without the need to add the medications that I mentioned earlier. And then I'd say, I just want to add, and I guess I've already mentioned, but the one that I think is more common to be missed is the ocular issues. And so consideration of ophthalmologic evaluation if that hasn't occurred. And look, and just a simple history of, is there intermittent treatment for conjunctivitis is almost a clue that there's recurrent red eye that might be related to something that's a more chronic consideration. So thank you for, obviously, this has been multiple considerations.
Hey, yeah, Dr. Howard, in the chat, there's a comment from Dr. Weimer about abdominal migraine again. So you touched on that. But then what about the overlap with something like complex regional pain syndrome, which is another neuro pain syndrome that, and is propranolol ever used in these situations?
Yeah. So it does seem like there's some overlap with that also. And again, because the diagnostic criteria are hard to apply to children with severe neurological impairment, But what I would add in is that sometimes there can be this history where there's a location on the body that recurrently has some of the features that can go along with that, which again raises the question about that being relevant. It tends to be kind of this category of autonomic features where there can be a limb that has recurrent flushing, as well as it's and swelling and seems more localized to have some tenderness. And so thinking of some of the other modalities that are used, if there, it's less common to see this, but that's a circumstance where I'd want to see about a localized intervention such as a TENS unit to see if that can be, it can achieve the symptom control that we would want for that child. So thank you, Dr. Weimer, because again, it's, we want to be comprehensive to think of what might be relevant that where we can apply the diagnostic criteria in the same manner in the patient population.
Yeah. So I guess I have a question for you. We often have these children come in on very long med lists.
Yes. You know,
and, you know, and we keep seeing people adding medication because these children seem to have such poorly controlled pain. So how do you approach a child who seems to be in a poor symptom management and start taking away medicines from that list or streamlining stuff?
Yeah, thank you so much, Glenn. This is one of the hardest tasks. The things that I always start with is I try to create a methodical process so that I look at all neuro-related drugs. I look to see what mechanisms of action that they have that include mechanisms that are beyond what its intended uses. So as an example, I want to see how many drugs have an anticholinergic effect, given that there are, it is astounding when you start to look how many do and how that can be additive. That become, and then the other reason I do that is I want to make sure I'm not adding things with similar mechanism of action that have already been in use without much added or any benefit, so that I can, and it's that history to try to tease out, which can be hard to replicate, but taking time to understand when was something added, what is the knowledge based on notes and a parent's memory as to what added benefit it had and was lost, but take all of that with a grain of salt. In that, part of it is there can be benefit from a medication, but because symptoms aren't completely eliminated, that a parent might worry that it has lost its benefit. I'm sorry that I'm talking a little bit in a jumbled way because it is complicated. One thing I'm always looking for, though, is that if I'm adding a drug, is there a drug I can wean down or wean off? So my most common example is if I'm adding a medication that has an anticholinergic effect, such as if I'm adding a tricyclic antidepressant, and a child is chronically on an anticholinergic for secretion management, I want to simultaneously decrease that dose as I'm increasing the tricyclic and potentially wean off, because to review that other medications are kind of replicating the effect of that. So we can determine what's needed at baseline. Benzodiazepines absolutely have a role. Their benefit chronically, as there's more added, is likely less than we would hope for. So I want to look to see who's added which for what reason, and look to see, is a child on two or more, to see, can I start weaning down on one of those potentially? But recognizing that that's typically a wean schedule over kind of 2.5 to 3 months, but at least to potentially decrease the dose that might be adding more side effects and less benefit. So if I were to summarize, it's trying to think what's being duplicated, what can we learn that might not have had as much benefit? And then the final point I'd make with this important question that you've asked, Glenn, is that a slow methodical process is the most important. Given the variation in symptoms in this population week by week, I try to keep things not just a week at a time, but ideally kind of a month at a time in my considerations for the chronic plan management. so that it's the longer a child is having some benefit, the less it requires much change done frequently, so that we're not upsetting the horse cart, so to speak. And then I see that Robert has his hand raised. So,
yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, just a note on this problem of multiple specialists and multiple specialists prescribing multiple judge drugs. This is something I noted working in urgent care clinics with patients. The bad thing about urgent care is we don't have any follow-up. But something that might be done or suggested to insurance companies is if they would hire case managers. Now, the next problem is, well, who's going to be a case manager? Because it used to be that the family doctor was the case manager. And, you know, my practice in San Antonio was from 1970 to 1989. After that, I went into the Navy because the HMOs were devastating my practice and my income. But at any rate, that is a problem that is causing great increase in cost, poor management of patients, and that is a issue I wish academics would address. I don't know what the solution is, but one of them is to have a case manager that knows what's doing.
Thank you, Dr. Weimer. And one aspect I can add to that is, for consideration, is making a distinction between acute exacerbations and chronic management. And what I mean by that is that when a child with SNI with multiple comorbid problems has an acute illness in the hospital, all of their comorbid problems frequently will be exacerbated. So their seizure spasticity, and including their neuropain symptoms. So during the acute phase, and this is obviously in need of study, but and I have a publication about this coming out later this year, but if we can make this distinction and routinely then make the consideration of, are we looking to have a bridge management plan to manage comorbid symptoms during the acute phase and then return to the chronic management plan, so that we're lessening just adding medications with this idea to manage problems chronically that are exacerbated in the acute setting, or at least that we start to come up with a model that makes the distinction between the two, and then who is best suited to make chronic decisions versus acute phase decisions of a bridge management plan, and also understanding at baseline how well is it managed. And then the second part that I'd say it also gets at is one hard part is we can achieve a good enough, and I mean that there's a shared agreement with a parent that this is good. In the acute setting, we all desire to fix problems. Problems due to the altered nervous system, it's hard because it kind of requires us to change our goal. And it's hard to accept that we can't eliminate or fix a problem. But again, I just wanted to name the complexity of this and get at what you were referring to, Dr. Weimer. And then finally, the one other aspect that some teams develop is embedding a pharmacist in their team structure so that there can be an expert to take some of that time to look at the chronic pain, chronic medication plan.
Thank you, Dr. Howard, so much for your presentation, and I think you'll make an impact on the department here. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the invite. Take care, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to that fascinating Grand Rounds talk. Don't forget to click on the link. See you next week. I'm Holly Waymond, and you're listening to Pediatrics Now. I hope that we are giving you information that's helpful, and we are covering topics that are meaningful to you. Please email me with episode ideas or comments. Our website is pediatricsnowpodcast.com. Fighting Fentanyl. That's an episode you can find in this Pediatrics Now newsfeed. We know there's so much to cover in the exam room and not enough time. We have a new podcast for the busy parent, and hopefully it's one less thing you have to say in the exam room. The website is pediatricsnowforparents.com, or you can find Pediatrics Now for Parents wherever you get your podcasts, including Audible. In Pediatrics Now for Parents, we cover almost every topic that's covered in this podcast, but it's health news in small bites for the busy parent. So if your patient is wondering about the measles outbreak or why they should consider getting their child vaccinated, you likely can find an episode on that on Pediatrics Now for Parents. The episodes run about 10 minutes or less.